Welcome, Cyrus No Rasta, to upcoming discs. And before we get started on the film we want to talk about, of course, I'd like to get a little bit of background on how you got into filmmaking. What was this process that got you into that career?
Well, you know, I loved movies as a kid. I did Super 8 stuff, and went to USC. I went to LA to go to film school at USC, and basically, it was just to get me to L.A., really.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't that many film schools at the time. This is the late 70s. So, I hung out in L.A., and everybody at that time used to say that writing was the best avenue in. So I decided to try my hand at screenwriting, and I worked, series television, wrote feature scripts, production rewrites, and basically worked my way into being a producer on some projects and a director on other projects.
Great. Now, it appears that you gravitate, or at least from your resume so far, it seems like you gravitate to these political and social issue type movies. Is that a conscious effort, or did that just happen?
Well, it's got to be conscious to some degree. The movies that I was always attracted to usually were true stories. History, current events. I remember seeing Lawrence of Arabia as a kid and thinking, boy, it would be amazing to recreate a historical period. I remember watching Missiles of October on television with William Devane and Martin Sheen as the Kennedy brothers, and
uh-huh.
just being riveted. And part of it has to do with just my own fascination with history and true stories and real people and real events, and those are the movies I like.
Well, and one of your early historical type movies was The Day They Shot Reagan, and you did that with Oliver Stone, and I gotta believe, from what I can see of your kind of political leanings and his, that must have been some dynamic.
I love Oliver.
Yeah?
He and I are friends. He helped me. That was a very important directing gig for me. And Oliver is a... Oliver likes it when you disagree with him.
That's good.
And the other thing is, Oliver's more conservative than he gives off. I think a lot of this is just reaction to... you can't find a more conservative movie than World Trade Center.
That's true.
Frankly.
That's true. I have to agree with you.
And there are other examples I can give you, too. I mean, I really... Oliver's a dichotomy.
Mm-hmm.
And he can't help himself. I think Nixon is a conservative movie. I don't think you can find a more sympathetic portrayal of Richard Nixon in that movie.
Well, I'd have to agree with you. I did enjoy that film a lot, actually.
I loved it. It's one of my favorites of his. And Midnight Express, which he wrote, I'd say is a pretty conservative film, too. I don't think you can make that movie today.
No, you're probably right. You're probably right. And getting to movies that I honestly surprised that you could make today, let's get on with the movie that we're here to talk about, and that is The Stoning of Soraya M. And I got to tell you, what drew you to this topic, to this subject?
Well, my family is Iranian, and although I was born and grew up here in the States, I lived in Iran at a young age for nearly 4 years. I speak the language, not perfectly, but I speak it pretty well, which is how I could make a movie in it.
Yeah, I noticed that they did. You speak a lot of Farsi in that film.
Yeah, there's a lot of subtitles in it. And also, I visited Iran as a young adult. So I would always gravitate to the Middle East section of the bookstores or whatever. And in 95, this book was released. I literally just picked it up at a bookstore and read it. It was a very powerful depiction of an actual stoning incident by a journalist. And I thought, boy, this could be a movie. This could be like an Oxbow incident.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt it would have an impact on what's going on in Iran, which I thought was, a tragedy.
Yeah.
So, but then I also gave it to my wife, who's also a screenwriter. Before Stoning, we were produced separately as writers.
Mm-hmm.
And she's American born and bred, and she couldn't get it out of her head. Now, at the time, we thought no way we could get this made. This was mid-90s. So I waited about 10 years later. I was shooting a miniseries in Morocco called The Path to 9/11.
Exactly, I know it.
And I thought, you could do Stoning here, because you could never shoot it in Iran.
Right.
And I thought post 9/11 there might be a chance for it to get made. So we decided to go after it, and it's really a miracle that this movie got made. Period.
Well, and that's why I said it was a perfect segue you gave me when you talk about a movie that you couldn't make today. I think there's a lot of people would say that it would be hard to make a movie like this today. And so you're right about that. Now, taking a look at it, you filmed this at a Middle East location. It looked like an actual village somewhere in the Middle East, and that must have been both a blessing and a curse. Can you tell me a little bit about the location you used?
Yeah, we filmed in Jordan. It's out on the internet now. We couldn't divulge it on the film. That was part of our contractual agreement. But now that it's all over, I don't care. I just think that they knew exactly what we were doing and what we were filming. They had no problem with it. We did have some problems locally with some of the local tribes for a whole myriad of reasons. It was an extraordinarily difficult shoot. If you watch the behind the scenes on the disc,
yes,
you'll get a sense of what we were dealing. And by the way, the lawyers forced him to cut out 5 minutes out of that behind the scenes because some of the stuff that he caught on film was so intense they were worried about lawsuits.
Oh my!
I think it's a great behind the scenes because it gives you, it's not just a puff piece about, and there's some of that because you know you had to put it in there. But in terms of just how chaotic it could get when you're making a film in a remote part of the world. And that village is worth its weight in gold. I went up and down the country trying to find the right village. I actually had a photograph of the actual village where the incident took place in Iran, and I wanted a village in the mountains. We found that as soon as I got out of the van. I told the guys, this is it. Because that for a low-budget movie, That village just gave us so much.
Yeah, I can see. And you know, you really should take some pride in the fact that I have to say a lot of behind the scenes things are the fluff you're talking about. But I've watched that, and you allow yourself to be shown in moments of frustration, in moments of things not going right. And that's rare. You don't see that as often in these making of sections. They only show when everything's going right.
No, you're right. I mean, it's an interesting story. My youngest son was in college. At the time, he took a semester off. He wanted to come over and work on the movie. We could not afford an EPK. We could not afford a behind-the-scenes unit.
Right.
So I told him, bring your Canon, and between helping us, just shoot some stuff, and you can edit it together, and we'll see if they put it on the disc. So, you know, being a very sort of strong-minded young man, he really didn't let me look at it or have much influence on the content.
Sure.
And I felt like, you know what, I told him it's his film, let him make it, and if they put it on a disc, great. And, yeah, he shows me in some very frustrated moments, but I felt like, you know what, it's unlike any other behind the scenes I've seen, and I think it's terrific.
Well, that's brave. That's brave, because a lot of directors won't allow themselves to be shown with frustration.
Yeah. Well, it can be a very frustrating and very frightening job, and you know we were shooting in a very remote part of the world where very few movies have been made. I think the last movie that had been shot near the area where we were shooting literally was Lawrence of Arabia.
Wow. Well, but it's authenticity, and I'm sure that's why you were there for it. It comes off on every moment of the screen.
Well, thank you. You're very kind. It was worth going over there. It was worth all the problems we had. And I also think, had a spectacular cast who were very committed to this movie and to the message, and everybody was really working hard.
Yeah, you can tell. Now, another thing you mentioned on the behind the scenes and in your commentary is that there were people who were literally afraid to participate either for themselves or their family, and with good reason, obviously. Were you ever afraid to do this?
No, you know, well, sure. I mean, I thought about it. My wife and I discussed it. I don't want you to think I'm, you know, Captain America. But I had been through a really horrible experience on a miniseries called The Path to 9/11 that I
right.
wrote and produced, where I became the target of kind of a partisan attack. And they, you know, some of these crazy, really fringe bloggers published my home address and phone number on the internet.
Oh my.
And I ended up getting a bunch of death threats and just hate mail. And when you're not used to that,
yeah,
you know, it can really throw you. So we'd sort of been through it on that, and I felt like we were better prepared this time out. And, you know, look, the film was condemned by the Iranian government. It was banned in Iran.
Right.
That's kind of backfired because it's now an underground hit in Iran. There are well over 20,000 bootleg DVDs inside the country being circulated by people. So, you know, I just, like I said, I'm thrilled that we were able to make this movie, that it's out there, and that your listeners and readers can see it, because you're right. It's a difficult movie to get made. It's a miracle it got made at all.
Yeah, I can definitely say that's true from what I've seen of it. Let's talk about this cast. It really is a remarkable cast. Obviously, very authentic actors. But I guess the main thing I want to get onto here is, and I'm probably going to misspell or mispronounce her name, but is it Mazran Marino? The girl plays.
Oh, Mojan Marno.
Excellent, and inexperienced actress. What made you think such an inexperienced actress could do such a good job?
Well, look, I needed an actress who can speak Farsi only. And so that limited my selection. But luckily, there's a very rich sort of Iranian cultural community, especially in Southern California. So when I went in find an actress for that role, and let's face it, the movie, you know, if she doesn't work, the movie doesn't work.
Exactly. That's what I mean.
You know, we auditioned probably about 30 different actresses. She came in. She's American of Iranian heritage. She speaks the language. She was not my vision of the role in any way, shape, or form, just physically.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's actually, I tried to film against this, but she's quite tall.
Yeah.
So anyway, what I did, and she's slender, and, you know, anyway, so what I did was, and she was younger than I would imagine the role, she came in and gave a knockout reading. Then I called her in again. My wife and I and the producers, we watched the audition, and we were blown away by her. So, you know what? She got the part, and she's fantastic in the movie.
Well, you know what? I want to also go through some of these characters and actors, because it seems to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but my interpretation are that each of these characters represents a certain aspect of the culture or a certain aspect of the story more than just even the person. So I was hoping that maybe I could, like, mention a couple of these characters, and you can give me a little background on what your thinking was and casting and such on them, if that's okay. Obviously, the big one is it Zahra, the aunt?
Yeah, that's Shoreh Agdashloo, who is Academy Award nominated for House of Sand and Fog, plays the aunt.
Yeah, and huge role in this film.
Yeah, she's great. She came aboard early on. I didn't even have producers, and she just read the script. I was able to get through. I had met her once socially, and she said, "I'm in." You know, there was no agent, no manager, no deal. She just said, "I'm in." So it's very rare that an actress of her repute will do that.
Mm-hmm.
And she's spectacular.
Now Hashem, am I? You have to help me if I mispronounce any of these names. But Hashem, that actor to me was also one of the best ones on there. And I don't know if you read in the review when I talked about, you know, that moment where he's got the rocks in his hand and he puts them down and hugs his son without saying anything. That's one of my favorite moments in the film, and that's all him.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for citing that moment. I find it a very powerful moment. The actor who played Hashem, his name is Parviz Sayad. He is a very prominent, well-known Iranian actor from decades ago, a performer, comedian, writer, filmmaker. He's really a Renaissance man, and in many ways was the Iranian Charlie Chaplin. He's a brilliant guy.
Yeah.
And he had to leave Iran, and actually the government had a lot of problems with him, and, you know, he had to live carefully for a while outside of Iran.
Sure.
And he's just another one of these guys who was committed to this movie and what it was about. And I actually, when we were writing the script, I had him in mind for the part.
So what did you tell him at that moment, just at the moment when that scene was? Did you give him any kind of direction, any kind of...
Well, here's what I do. I have a very specific idea of what I want and what I'm going after, but on the first takes or even in the rehearsal, especially in the rehearsal, I don't tell the actors anything.
Right.
Because I want to see what talent brings to it. A lot of these actors, you know, have worked for many years and are very bright, creative people, and sometimes they'll surprise you with something that's so right and so good and so much better than anything you may have had in mind. And that's all him. You know, I just said to him, let me see what you want to do.
Yeah.
And he just had the right instincts. And that's really just me sitting back, best seat in the house, and watching with pleasure.
Well, he nailed it, I got to tell you.
Yeah.
Absolutely nailed it. Of course, the Mullah. Now, that character, I don't know what it is, but he looks so familiar to me, and I couldn't see him in any credits of things that I've seen before, but there's something about him that seems so familiar to me. What can you tell me about that character and actor?
Well, you know, he mostly does Iranian theater, and he's done some other Iranian films. Now, he's also had some small parts. He speaks English perfectly. He's a terrific actor. You know, like I said, there's a whole community of Iranian theater troops and Iranian television, because there's nearly 500,000 Iranian exiles in Southern California. So they have their own like industry here.
Sure.
These guys, they all work all the time. These are experienced actors. And he's just great. I worked with him briefly once before. And I had, once again, while I was writing it, I had him in mind for the part. The part of the husband of Soraya.
Uh-huh. Ali.
Yeah, I worked with that actor, Navid Negabon. I worked with him on Path to 9/11 and had him in mind for the role. I think he is sensational in the movie. And, you know, it's a tough part to play, that guy. You're playing a real son of a gun.
Yeah, he's the guy who causes all the trouble, so he's the bad guy in the movie.
Essentially, you don't get much badder.
No.
And I thought he was great.
And again, his moment for me, and I don't, once again, it may take you back to Bart. His moment for me is the scene at the stoning where he goes back to check on her. To me, he's more evil there than when he's dancing around, spreading the accusations and trying to plot against his wife. That moment, to me, is the most evil moment in the movie.
Yeah, you know, he goes to check on her, and then he goes back and he says to the guys, the bee is still alive, right? And then they do the final thing. But
and the look in his face when he says that, it's manic.
What I also like from him, which I think he gave me, is after they've all left, he goes up to look at her one more time.
Yeah.
And in his eyes, for a fleeting instant, is the recognition of the horror that he's done, and then he staggers away.
Yeah.
And you know, of course, he's going to get over it because he's that kind of narcissist. He's
right.
In his own world. And of course, the next time you see him, he's complaining about the fact that he couldn't, you know...
He didn't get what he wanted anyway.
Didn't get what he wanted, right.
Yeah.
And it's all about him. All he talks about is what he wanted.
Right. Now, talking about the stoning itself, now, I've covered this in the review as well, but I have heard from people a lot of criticism about the graphic nature of it and such. I contend it was necessary. How do you respond to the criticism that you've obviously hearing out there about the brutality of that scene?
Well, you know, it's something, because the New York Times reviewer described it as exaggerated and torture porn. And,
I've heard that as well, and it doesn't make sense.
I just would say to him, see the real thing. I felt a responsibility, because I've seen videos of real stoning. I felt a responsibility to those victims that no one's going to walk away from this movie having seen sanitized violence.
Right.
Now, if I've gone so far that people are streaming out of the theater, then clearly I've gone too far.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah, I haven't, because we tested it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt that when people walk out of this movie, the next time they read on the internet or hear about a pending stoning, and we just had a big story about it just a few days ago.
Exactly. That's when you came to my attention.
Yeah, they will know what it is. And I just, you know what, I felt it was the right way to go. I still do. And a lot of times these reviewers, you know, they don't watch the movie with an audience.
Right.
They don't see how people respond to this movie. I've sat in full houses when this was in the theaters or playing at festivals, and people sit there stunned at the end of this movie, and almost in shock. There are tears, yes, but then they sit in their seat till the lights come on, and then they applaud.
Exactly.
So, you know, I stand by the choice. I understand why it's controversial for some. I understand why it's a difficult movie for some. I get it.
But if you want to leave the audience with an impact, you almost have to, don't you?
Well, yeah, you do. And it's just, you know, what it comes down to is in each and every scene, in each and every moment of your picture, I think it was John Huston who said this, you want to tell the truth. And you want to find the truth of the moments, of the scene, of the heart of what it's about. And I just think you've got to do it. Otherwise, you're kind of lying to yourself or to the audience.
I'm going to tell you, Sam, you're talking to someone who watches all kinds of movies, and I actually do enjoy some of the horror stuff that you know, some of the people talk about. And I got to tell you, it didn't feel to me, as someone who's watched a ton of that, like I was watching that at all. It didn't. I can watch that stuff and walk away and not feel anything, but you don't feel that. This is unforgettable. And I guess that's the part that maybe most people don't understand, and maybe it's how you did it. Maybe it's the context of the whole film, but you're talking to somebody who can watch that kind of stuff, and this didn't feel like that at all. And that's what I was trying to say.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, I think what you said is absolutely right. It's the context of the whole film. It's like you are immersed in the reality of this world and these people. And as the story proceeds and progresses, they become real to us.
Well, I think that to do anything else would have denigrated the whole thing.
Oh, thank you.
I do have one question about the ending, however. I call it the gladiator ending. I was wondering what your thoughts were, what you were trying to say with the, you know, after she goes the in the fields with her children. I assume those are her daughters. What's going on there? I don't know that I quite understand that ending.
You mean the ending of the stoning sequence?
Yes, exactly. When she's in the field with her, like I said, I suspect those are her daughters.
Well, yeah, basically, what we were going for was she's thinking about her daughters, and for her, heaven is with her daughters. This is basically her last thought, her exit to the other place.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to put it in there. I think that the whole thing with the birds that ties to the sequence earlier in the movie when she was out in the field with her kids.
Yes, I remember.
And that's what we were going for. And, you know.
I guess the reason why I ask is because one of the things that confused me, I was wondering if maybe you were trying to say that maybe her daughters were in some way killed as well or lost their lives in this incident.
No, you know, because we do cross-cut to where the daughters are in the house with her friend.
But I meant for maybe later. Maybe that was trying to tell us that they were rejoined soon after or something.
No, I wasn't going for that. I haven't heard that, but it was really just, you know, because the very second prior to that, we're basically on her eyes. We're really tight on her.
Right.
The idea is we're going into her thoughts.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I have to tell you that the best scene for me, and I'd like you to tell me a little bit something about this, the best scene for me in the whole movie, the best image, is towards the end when you do the long cut with the sunset and just the dust clouds rising from the last volley of rocks coming up. Where did that come from? That's brilliant.
You're talking about the long shot.
Right, where you see it looks like there's either sunset or something. It's like an orangish sky, and then you see the dust from the final volley just rising up from the ground.
Yeah, that was what happened there was look, I know I'm going to shoot a long and protracted stoning sequence in this movie. And what I'm trying to think of, okay, if it's too much, if I need to cut out, what can I cut to?
Right.
What are my choices and what are my options? We were driving one day towards the village. I think it was when we were prepping or something. And I noticed there was some activity down the village with some with a truck or one of the vehicles, and it was kicking up dust, and we could see it from up there.
Right.
And with the sun in the distance, it just occurred to me, you know what? Let's try and recreate that and get a long shot from way up on the hill overlooking the village, just to give us a breather.
Yeah.
From the stoning sequence, my DP, who is a great director of photography, loved the idea, and we just put our heads together and figured out a way to make it work.
Yeah. It looks really good, although, and we've talked about this before as well, man, I hope that you find a way to fight for a better transfer. I mean, it looks decent, but they used old technology. I'm hoping that you can convince Lionsgate or whoever to release a really nice new edition of this movie. It deserves another edition.
Well, the next movie I do with Lionsgate, which is not set yet, but mm-hmm. that'll be part of the deal, part of the contract.
There you go. Just don't blame me. So I've
You're
already
right.
kept you longer than I promised, so I'll cut this short. But I just wanted to end by saying, what else do you have come? Is there anything you can talk about? Anything you can push for right now? Telling us what's next on your journey.
Well, I got a couple of interesting things. One is I've written a script already. It was brought to me as a strict screenwriting assignment. But once they saw my saw Stoning, they decided to attach me to direct. It's a book called The Last Campaign, which is about Robert Kennedy's 82-day run for the presidency. It's literally behind the scenes of this extraordinary campaign in 1968 until mm-hmm. he was shot by Sirhan in Los Angeles.
Right.
And in my movie, you'll know why Sirhan shot him. The other thing is we're basically chasing down an actor on that one right now. And then Anne Rice, the author.
Right, the vampire lady.
Yeah, she saw The Stoning of Sir I.M. On Blu-ray, just like you did.
Yeah.
And she flipped over it. She wrote a review of it on her Facebook site. She went on the Amazon page and wrote a review. She contacted us, sent us a book through her agent that we responded to, and we just made a deal on it. I'm going to write it with my wife again, and I will direct it. It's based on a book called Christ the Lord Out of Egypt. It's about Jesus as a 7-year-old boy. It's an extraordinary book.
Wow. So when can we see either of these projects?
Well, Last Campaign, the script's already done, and we're chasing an actor. So, you know, hopefully we'll be shooting, I think, I'm hoping, fingers crossed, second quarter of 2011.
Well, that's not bad. That's pretty soon.
Yeah, so, you know, we're working on it. You know how the movie business is.
Yeah, and I'll look for it, and hopefully we'll be able to talk to you again in the future about these other projects.
Anytime. I really appreciate your attention to, you know, the detail and everything else, so it's a pleasure.
It's my pleasure as well, and I appreciate you taking the time here to talk to us. Sorry for keeping you a little longer than I promised.
My pleasure, Gino.
Well, you take care and have a good trip. And like I said, I'm going to look you up when this next movie comes out, okay?
You bet. Thank you.
All right. You take care of yourself. All right.
All right.
Bye.